Hello, welcome to episode 3 of the BYU Animation Podcast. I'm Aaron Ludwig. We were recently privileged to be visited by storyboard artist, director, and producer Steve Hickner. Steve's career has spanned both feature and television animation, as he's worked on everything from storyboards on He-Man and Fat Albert to directing The Prince of Egypt and B-Movie. He gave two fantastic presentations during his visit, the first on story structure. This is part 2 of that presentation.
Okay, I want to show one or two more insight instances. I'm going to move on to something else with it. I think you got it. No, actually, I'm not going to do that. I just realized, you know, I don't really have any notes on this. What I have is a bunch of clips I want to show, and it's very organic. If someone asks questions and things, I'll move on to that. Because as you can see, I got a million clips here to go. But now I think I'll show insight incident later, but I'm going to now go back for a sec, and I'm going to do a short film. And this one, because I want to, because a lot of times people think, yeah, but that's a feature. And I want to show the timeline for Luxo Jr., the John Lasseter award-winning short, which I timed out is 94 seconds. 94 seconds. 8 seconds into the movie is the inciting incident. 28 seconds into the movie is plot point one. 48 seconds in is the midpoint. Something happens. And I'm going to show you the short, and then I'm going to play it again, and I've embedded inciting incident right on it. You see it? 78 seconds is that. Because I want to show you that in your films, this is applicable. So let me go to Luxo Jr. First, I'm going to show it without that stuff, so you can just see it. And then I'm going to play it with this stuff embedded in. And unfortunately, somehow when I did that, I did it in, it became like there was a 6.7 earthquake, and it kind of jiggles a little, but it's still okay. So here's Luxo Jr. It's only 94 seconds long. But it's very cute. Simple movie, but it's the Steamboat Willie of the Pixar universe. This is the one that started it. But it has all the hallmarks of what makes a Pixar movie great. It has simple characters that you recognize and you feel emotionally for them. So you see how that fell into that, what Sid Field calls the story structure paradigm? The inciting incident was the ball rolling in. That gets the ball rolling, but the story started. The Luxo Jr. coming in was plot point one. That changes the story in a new direction. The midpoint was when Luxo Jr. jumps on the ball, because that's going to pop the ball, and that's what he's going to get admonished for doing. And plot point two is when the mother light balls out Luxo Jr. and leads towards the resolution. So as I say, even in a simple film, it still falls. You don't have to be slave to those exact timings. But I must say for myself, I always go through and audit when I'm on a movie if we're hitting these marks, where they happen. because you know what? You start moving away from 28 minutes, you will start to feel it. It feels fat. So the great thing about this, and the reason why I wanted to give this lecture, and so you could apply it to your film before you get started, you can audit your movie right now and time it and say, boy, our plot point one doesn't come in until, you know, 2.5 hours into the short. That's probably a little late. So whatever it is. But you don't have to be, you know, crazy about that. As I showed you, that not all movies are like that. I'm going to show a... just because I love this movie. And it's a musical, which is kind of a different thing. But you'll see the plot point, the thing will come up in the lyrics of the story. So this is the opening of Hairspray. And this is a movie, if you haven't seen it, it's a musical about integration. When they got once a month we have Negro Day, everybody stops. Because that is going to be very, very important in the story. It's going to be the main conflict. It's a story about integration in the 1950s. It's what makes this movie, I think what makes this play succeed when so many other musicals fail. Because it actually is about something. It has it has a point to make.
I've been asked to keep it a little bit quieter so the class next door can. Anyway.
So they didn't want to hear Hairspray. Okay. Now I'm going to take something else. When I was in college, my mother was a voracious reader. She loved to read biographies, and she would read things. And one day she was reading the biography of Josh Logan. You may not know, but he was a theater musical director. He did films, too. He did, like, Carousel and Oklahoma and stuff like that on Broadway, but he also did Mr. Roberts, which he was fired off of, which is another lesson that no matter how good you are, you can still be fired. But during the course of that discussion, she said, I'm reading this Josh Logan book, and there's something in here that would be interesting to you, because I was going to film school at the time. And so I took the book, and this was like over 30 years ago, and I read it, and I go, gosh, that's really smart. And so I carry it with me and at work and Xerox it, and I'm going to read it to you now because it's about what I think makes a movie, why people watch movies 70 years later, and why All About Steve will be gone, you know, Saturday when it opens on Friday. So this is from his biography. And this is another thing I can say to you. You don't have to be the smartest guy. All you got to be is smart enough to find the smartest guys. And that's what I try to do, is to gain from my betters, the people who are way, way, way smarter than I am. Anyway, so this is from his book. And as I say, I read this at some point in every movie I've ever worked on. I pull this out and I audit the movie against this. Okay, so it was working closely with Max Anderson, a man dedicated to the craft of playwriting that taught me something that has been useful to me all my professional life. One day he casually mentioned that he'd arrived at a theory for making a play a hit. My ears perked up. You mean any play? Any literate play, yes. I've made a study of what kind of story an audience accepts and what kind it rejects. And I set out to discover if there isn't a single element in successes that isn't in failures. I started by examining my own plays. They were, after all, conceived by the same talent, yet some survived and the rest disappeared and died quickly. Why? I searched for my answer in Aristotle, and I reread Shakespeare, the great Greek masters, and the hit plays of the present. Eventually, I arrived at my little personal rule. I'm going to write about it someday, and I'll send it to you. Max, you're going to tell me now. What is it? Well, it turns out that it was in Aristotle all the time. And also, and you don't know Aristotle, he wrote this book, Poetics, Aristotle's Poetics, which is actually the primer of all modern drama. And by that I mean even present day. That's drama. Well, it turns out it was in Aristotle all the time, and it was also in all of the great Shakespeare plays, in all of the strong plays, anywhere, anytime. What is the rule, Max? Here it is. A play should take its protagonist through a series of experiences which lead to a climactic moment towards the end when he learns something, discovers something about himself that he could have known all along but has been blind to. That discovery comes as such an emotionally shattering blow, and that's the key word, emotionally, that it changes the entire course of his life. And that change must be for the better. If he's changed for the worse, the audience will reject the play, as they do Troilus and Cressida, which I've never heard of, and all other failures. I guess that's why I never heard of it. The audience must feel and see the leading man or woman become wiser, and discovery must happen on stage in front of their eyes. That's critical. And that doesn't mean a happy ending. If the hero is to die, and he just must make the discovery before he dies. Of course, the classic example is Oedipus. But it's true of Hamlet and Macbeth down the line, even to Jeter Lester and Tobacco Road and Dalaud and Green Pastures. You'll find it in every successful play. For when the protagonist has this revelation, one which raises his moral stature, the audience can grow vicariously along with him. Thus the people leave the theater feeling better, healthier-minded than they would arrive. And it's an exciting experience, and that excitement makes plays live. And he writes, I've used this play to some extent on every play I've done. It has strengthened the weak ones and often saved, strengthened strong ones and often saved the weak ones from disaster. George Axelrod, who wrote a fine screenplay I directed, Marilyn Monroe and Bus Stop, calls it Logan's Law. Anyway, now I'm going to show you one of the great movies of all time that's going to be 70 years old next year. And the reason it's around is because of this very thing. In it, we get to see the character grow. And it's very satisfying. So the first clip I'm going to show you is, and this little motion picture is called Casablanca, is, let's see, is where we meet, you know, Rick Blaine, who is the Humphrey Bogart character, and he is going to tell us his philosophy. This is the way Rick Blaine is, which is why he's in Casablanca. Okay, so that line of Bogart saying, I stick my neck out for nobody, that's the jaded character that he is. Of course, he really isn't that, as we're going to find out. So at the end of the movie, now I'm going to, if you haven't seen Casablanca, it is about to be ruined for you. And to that, I make no apologies. You should have seen it. So there you go. So this is the end of Casablanca, which in digest version, earlier in the movie, Peter Lorre comes into Casablanca with these letters of transit. And with these letters, and they're like the get-out-of-jail-free card for there. They're under Nazi occupation, and with these letters of transit, anybody can leave, and it's uncontested because they're signed by somebody at the very top. So with these letters, Bogart can leave Casablanca if he wants. So they are the most valuable commodity in this. Because at the end of the day, Casablanca is really like a prison for all those people. They can't get out. And it's, you know, they have this bar and things, but they really can't get out. This movie is so witty, too. I love the way, as you'll see, when Bogart comes up and he tells Louis, who's the Claude Rains character, to do this. And, of course, he's not going to do it. He immediately gets somebody else to do it. It's so witty. It's such a good movie.
Mr. Nelson's luggage and put it on the plane.
Yes, sir.
This way.
If you don't mind, you fill in the names. That'll make it even more official.
You think of everything, don't you?
And the names of Mr. and Mrs. Victor Laszlo.
But what am I in English?
If you're getting on that plane.
Are you going to say, what about you?
I'm saying it was him who tried to get safely away.
No, Richard,
you know
what's happened to your last
life. Last night, we said a great many things. You said I was to do the thinking for both of us. Well, I've done a lot of it since then, and all adds up to one thing. You're getting on that plane with Victor where you belong to.
Richard, no,
now, you've got to listen. You have any idea what you've got to look forward to if you say this? 9 chances out of 10, we both wind up at a concentration camp. Isn't that true?
I'm afraid Mr. Sutter would insist.
You're saying this only to make me go.
I'm saying it because it's true. Inside of us, we both know you belong with Victor. And part of his work, the thing that keeps you going. That train leaves the ground, and if you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon, for the rest of your life.
What about us?
Oh, we have parents. We didn't have. We lost it until you came to Casablanca. We got it back last time. for you. You can't follow what I've got to do. You can't be any part of it. Look, I'm no good at being noble. It doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that. I don't know. This will be easy, kid. Something you should know before you leave. Mrs. Green, I don't ask you to explain anything. I'm going to anyway because it may make a difference to you later on. Is that you know about Hilda and me? Yes. She didn't know she was at my place last night when you were. She came there for letters of transit, isn't that true, Hilda?
Yes.
She tried everything to get them, and nothing worked. She did her best to convince me that she was still in love with me. That was all over long ago. For your sake, she pretended it wasn't, and I let her pretend. Understand. Here it is. Thanks. I appreciate it. Welcome back to flight. This side of our side will win.
That scene is why the movie will be shown long after I'm gone. Is when Rick, you know, says to Laszlo that lie about Ilsa in him. That it's killing him. He loves Ilsa. That's why he's in Casablanca. Those period of days that when you were in Paris together. He loved her so much, he banished the song As Time Goes By from there because it reminds him of her, and that's why he's in this place to numb himself with alcohol in this hellhole of a place, because he wants to be as far away from her as he can. And when it's rekindled, he does the most noble thing he can possibly do because he knows it's right. She should be with him. And so he gives up his own personal happiness and helps the cause of this freedom fighter by doing that. And it's the complete opposite of this axiom that he gives at the beginning of the movie, that he sticks his neck out for no one. In fact, he is just the opposite. He is the most selfless person imaginable. And that's what Josh Logan's talking about. That's what makes movies live, that kind of thing. And if you're lucky enough to do that, you can make a movie that will last for a long, long time. So now I'm going to read another thing that this is about set pieces. And what happened was, when I was working on Balto with Simon Wells, we had this meeting with Steven Spielberg in Los Angeles, and we went over and showed him our story reel. And we got notes for the whole thing, and as we were leaving the room, we were walking with Steven down the hallway, and Steven stopped, and he says, "I wonder." And we said, "Well..." But he goes, I wonder if Balto has the kind of set pieces that you associate with animation. And I said to him, yeah, it does. We have blah, 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 blah. And he says, okay, all right. And off we went. About a year and a half later, we were in the dubbing stage. and we're, you know, that process where you're mixing down the film to the final things. And I'm watching the movie, and, oh, I turned to Simon, I said, Simon, I got it. He said, what? I said, do you remember about a year and a half ago, we were at Amblin with Steven, and he made that mark, and he wondered if we had the kind of set pieces that someone associated with animation. He goes, yeah. I said, I think I know what he means. And we don't have them. He was right. Listen, when someone tells you something, don't talk them out of it. Even if you think you're right, don't discard it that quickly as we did. Because it took me a year and a half to finally catch up to what I think Steven meant. And because I always thought a set piece was kind of like a sequence that was kind of meaningless in the movie, one that, you know, you would show that wasn't that important. And then I realized, I think I know what Steven meant. Is I think what he meant by a set piece was a sequence which, if you took out of the movie and watched it by itself, you would have a feeling of the whole movie, even if you haven't seen it. And I compare that to a pie. You have a piece of pie. If you cut a slice of the pie and taste it, you know what the rest of the pie tastes like. You don't have to eat the whole pie to know. You got it from one slice. I think that's what Steven was talking about. And then I thought about it, and I said, you know what? All the great movies are those. And the really great movies, every single sequence is one of those slices of the pie. If you go to Wizard of Oz, every sequence is like that. You go, you know, you have the moment where you land in Oz. And then the next moment, you're going to meet the Scarecrow. Well, that's a great moment. And then you're going to go meet the Tin Man, and that's a great moment. And the Cowardly Lion. And on and on. In Casablanca, they're all like that. Every scenes I showed you are like that. In The Godfather, another movie I adore, they're all like that, every scene. And I realized, by doing it, that there were two kinds of scenes. There were those, and there were ones that get you from A to B. And the ones that get you from A to B, you can lose. Because they're not that compelling. And the really good filmmakers know how to make them all like that. And then on Little Mermaid, when I was working with John, there was one day where it was a Friday, and that was when we had to get all the things done, if you remember, all the cleanup done. And I had these tests to show to John, and John was looking at one of the tests. This wasn't one of your scenes, by the way. Just so we can absolve you from that. And he said, oh. And I said, what? And he said, he took a character scene and he made it personality. The animator. And I thought, oh, that's the scene. That's the subset of the thing. That it happens on a shot level and on a scene level. That, you know, a good animator in a good scene, and I really felt this on Prince of Egypt, where every shot was something an animator wanted to animate. That's the way they should be. Every shot should make you say, I want to do that one. If you've got shots that go, you can do that one. Then, you know, those are the continuity scenes. They get you from A to B, which means there is something missing, and if it is, it's going to be lifted at some point in the making of the movie. So with that said, I'm reading this book called Me and Hitch, which is written by Evan Hunter, who was the writer on The Birds for Hitchcock. And in the book, there's a correspondence where the author is talking about writing Hitchcock. He goes, in a 5-page letter from Hitch, dated November 30th, 1961, after he'd gone over the first draft of a couple of times and shown it to some 8 or 9 of his technical and production personnel, he went into elaborate detail on the various problems he and his people had found. The problem most frequently cited amongst them was that Melanie and Mitch, that's the Rod Taylor and the Tippi Hedren characters, seemed insufficiently characterized. The next problem, and this seemed particularly to concern Hitch, was that there were too many no-scene scenes in the script. By this, I mean that the little sequence... This is Hitchcock. By this, I mean that the little sequence might have narrative value, but in itself is undramatic. It is very obviously lacks shape, and it doesn't within itself have a climax on a scene as a scene on the stage might. You would have to detail these scenes at great length and list them. But I thought, that's Hitchcock talking about this. That's what he's saying. And he's come up with a great term, the no-scene scenes. The scenes, and it can be a shot, or it can be a scene. And if you've got a no-scene scene, there's stuff happening. But it, as he says, it doesn't build in a theatrical, dramatic fashion. And those are the first ones to get lifted from the movie. And if they stay in, it feels flabby. And if you get enough of them, you're making All About Steve or whatever will be the, you know, the Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, the Razzie winner of next year. The original Wicker Man is good. Are you talking about the one with Nicolas Cage?
I'm talking about the one with Nicolas Cage.
Wow. Because that first one was actually good. But which is why they remade it into a rotten version. Okay, so now I'm going to show you from To Kill a Mockingbird a very much not a no-scene scene. This one crackles. It's fantastic. And in a microcosm, and I show this because this is like your shorts. And basically, you know, not every film needs, some of them are just fun. Like, there's not a big thing in Luxo Jr., the short. You're not getting a big character thing. It's just kind of charming that it's the mom and the kid story. And it's fun. But To Kill a Mockingbird is a big drama, and it's about racism, and it has some important themes. So this is a very weighted clip. And if you haven't seen the movie or read the book, it's really good. But I don't have to tell you that. You must have heard of To Kill a Mockingbird. So, but watch how, and I show this clip, how long is it? Just out of curiosity, see if it will list. It's 7 minutes. No, it's six. It's a little over 6 minutes. Okay, so it's around the length of a film. This. And look at how it does exactly what Hitchcock's talking about. It has a shape. You start at one place, you end at another, and the conflict grows, and you see the change in a character. So this is enough preamble, really. It's time to get on with it. That was all fluffy while I try to figure out where is it. Okay, here we are. So this is To Kill a Mockingbird. And this is directed by Robert Mulligan. And you know the story, right? An African American or a black guy or a Negro back at this day that this was made is accused of raping a white girl. So it's a whole thing about racism. And Gregory Peck plays the lawyer hired to defend him. And is told through the eyes of the girl named Scout.
Come on.
Don't wait. You know what we want. Get aside from that door, Mrs. Finch. Walter. I think you ought to turn right around and go back home. I can take you around here somewhere.
No, he ain't. His wife's got to take that old man looking for us.
No, he was. We come here the other way.
You ain't even thought about that, has you? Let's talk about it.
I can't be asked.
Well, that changes. Take Chuck and Bill home with you. Son, I said go home.
Nope.
Well, I said go home.
I was saying how the audience lives vicariously through the character. With that, man, you know, it breaks down because he's no longer anonymous. Scout, I know your son Walter. He starts to humanize the character. He can't be this mob rule anymore. He feels bad about it. And when that character turns and says, let's go, let's all get out of here, you feel great. And you could feel it in the room, how somber that clip was, and how touched, and how people were affected by that clip. That was exactly what I was talking about. When that happens on screen, I wasn't talking, Josh Logan was talking about, when that happens on screen, it is electric. That's why people go to the movies. And it doesn't always have to be a happy ending. The character can do something that's selfless, do the right thing and die. But it will still, you'll still feel good about it. And so that's an example of both things, that Josh Logan thing, and it also is building a scene. You can see the beginning, and I was writing down when it was running, and I didn't think of this till too late. It was like a little over 6 minutes, but at 3 minutes and 30 seconds, Scout says, "Oh, Mr. Owens," she pulls him out of the thing and starts talking to him. 3 minutes and 30 seconds in. My guess, and I was wondering, is I wonder if that scene, that six-minute thing, is going to fall within that inciting incident, which is the mob showing up. Plot point one, which is the kid showing up. Midpoint, which is, you know me, I know your son Walter. And then plot point two, which is when he starts to feel bad about it and leaves. I was wondering, I wonder if that's going to be. And my guess is, the answer is probably yes. It's probably going to fall within that subset. Even just talking about it right now, you can see even that scene is going to be a subset of a bigger thing, which is why I say that the really good movies are made up of nothing but these. And you go from one of those to another, to another, to another. And they don't have to be so heavily dramatic. Wizard of Oz is not. Casablanca is kind of like a balance. It's a drama, but it has many comedic elements in it. Does anybody have any questions? I never stop. I never pause to ask anybody if they had any questions. So now you can ask questions anywhere for the hour and a half, 45 minutes.
Yeah. I have a question for you, Steve.
You can call me whenever you like. No, don't call me Mr. Hagen. Okay, don't call me Mr. Hagen. Yeah, really.
My question is that a lot of the...
I'm sorry, what's your name first?
My name's Anthony Holden.
Because now you're not an anonymous. Now the mob rule is over.
So the question, I guess, is after watching Bogey, favorite of mine, and you watch, the Wizard of Oz and things like that, and stuff like that, it's classic. Now we've watched them as classics, and I feel like the stories still hold up, but if you told the story today like that, I guess, like, I expect that viewers are almost sophisticated.
Good. Let's go to the next clip. No. It's good. We'll have you come tomorrow. When I get to this point tomorrow, bring up... Because I was thinking the same thing. It's going to look like every movie I show, like I'm this old fogey that only sees old black and white movies.
Well, see, but I guess the question...
But I'm going to show one that's contemporary.
To Kill a Mockingbird that we just watched, like, I start tearing up at that still. And Humphrey Bogart gets me because, like, his movies are classic, and, like, I can watch that, and I'm like, okay.
But is there anybody alive?
Right, but, like, yeah, the minute that little girl starts talking, I'm like... And I don't know what it is about that or what your thoughts on that are, like why it feels really contemporary still, even though that movie was made.
Well, I think what makes it feel contemporary is the emotional resonance that the story has. Because there are many things in there that are, like, for instance, in Wizard of Oz, they have that cutaway to the... when they're in that last clip I showed, plot point three, they had to cut away to the hourglass with the sand coming out to remind you that time is running short. You'd never do that today. You'd never do. In Casablanca, the middle of that scene, they have to cut away to that Nazi guy driving to cut back. Look, we don't need to be reminded of the ticking clock, we know. Those are, to me, artifacts of the type of movie they made back then. And I was mentioning in one of the classes today that in those days, a montage was such a shocking thing that they actually would have somebody else hired to do it. Because, like in the case of Michael Curtiz in Casablanca, he did not direct the Paris montage. I think that was Don Siegel. And I was talking about this movie, Body and Soul, which is a boxing movie. There's a montage, and that was directed by Robert Aldrich, who later became a protege of Sam Peckinpah and became a big director on his own, as did Don Siegel. So that's how compartmentalized things were back in the studio system. You wouldn't have possibly have that today. A guy, another director would come in and do a montage. But let's go to a movie where somebody is still alive. Okay? And this is... I read that... And you know, it's going to sound like I do a lot of reading. I would love to say that I am a great reader, but I think by the end of this, I will have exhausted every book I've read. And I'm not proud of that. I was just reading a book, and it said that the people who achieved best in school at a younger age were the ones who would read the most. That if there was one direct correlation between success in academics and a behavior, reading is it for young children to read and being successful in school as they get on is a direct correlation. Now, I didn't read much at all as a kid, and that didn't serve me well. What was the point of that? Other than, that this book on a Hitchcock Truffaut book, which is a whole bunch of interviews of Francois Truffaut interviewing Hitchcock. Hitchcock says, Truffaut puts these words in his mouth. Are you saying, Hitchcock, that the better the villain, the better the picture? And he said, yes. The more defined the black, the brighter the white. In his kind of movie. See, there's a bell ringing that's an important fact. So now I'm going to show you a scene of a really compelling villain. And it seems like every time I show a compelling villain things, they're all sociopaths. They're always Hannibal Lecter, and this guy is not. It's Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men. And this guy's nuts. But you're on the edge of your seat for where this is going.
Homeless. 69 seat. Let me guess. You all get any rain up here, what? What way would that be? I've seen you with some fabulous. What business is of yours? Where I'm from? Friendo. I don't mean that by good rainbow. Just passing the time.
That's the way it is.
What's the most you ever lost in a coin toss?
Sir?
The most you ever lost in a coin toss?
I don't know. I couldn't see.
Coin.
Coin, yes.
For what?
Just coin.
Well, we need to know what we're coming for here.
You need to call it. I can't call it for you.
It wouldn't be fair.
I didn't put nothing up.
Yes, you did. You've been putting it up your whole life. You just didn't know. You know what day you saw this coin?
No.
1958. Same traveling 22 years to here. A knowledge here. And they said heads and tails. I didn't have to say coin.
Well, look, I need to know what I say in the wind.
Everything.
How's that?
You send away everything, call it.
All right. It's in.
Well done.
Don't put it in your pocket, sir.
Don't put it in your pocket, just let it water.
Where do you want me to put it?
Anywhere, not in your pocket. Well, I've been messing with the others and becoming just a coin. Which is?
That to me is an excruciating scene. You are just on the edge of your seat in that scene because of the writing and the actors and the way it is. Now, what we don't know is that is a setup for another scene that is coming. And I'm going to talk about, first I'll show the scene, I'll talk about that. That is cinema, by the way.
I ain't got the money. But the lie is long gone and there's bills of plenty to pay yet. I believe my mother today ain't paid for that neither.
I wouldn't worry about it.
I need to see that.
No. But I gave my word.
You gave your word?
Your husband.
That don't make sense. You gave your word to my husband and family?
Your husband had the opportunity to say it yet. Instead, did you see the trying to save himself?
Not like that. Not like he said. You don't have to do this.
Oh, it's this.
What did they say?
They say you don't have to do this. Yes, I can do. God.
I know she was crazy when I saw you sitting there. I know exactly what was in store for me.
God.
Say hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work. I go, ho, and go are rhymes. And in movies, we have the same thing. Sometimes we call it a rhyme. Sometimes we call it a setup and a payoff. That was a rhyme. How do we know, or most likely, that she's dead? That he killed her? Because of the setup. Because of the scene in the gasoline station earlier. That you know this guy's a sociopath, and when he does that game, everything is indeed at stake. Your life. And they don't ever say it in the movie, but the implication is she picked the wrong way. She's gone. So, in movies, that rhyme can be used in many, many ways. And in fact, it's a great, great tool to use to show that a character has changed sometimes. I know it's fine. And that's all.
You got a couple minutes, but you do need to wrap it up.
All right, well, I don't know what I'm saying, but it's true. But in movies, we have the same things with rhymes. I like to take characters back through the same steps to show how they're changed. On Prince of Egypt, I deliberately suggested at the end of the movie, when Moses comes back after the angel of death has wiped everybody out, we're all firstborn in Egypt, that Moses go through the same places we saw him go through in happier times. Because he deliberately wanted to take the audience through those steps to show how the character has changed and how the movie has changed. And when you do that, it's me, you're using that as like a cinematic yardstick to show. Have the audience measure up the characters and go, oh, I see how they came. Sometimes it's used like this as a story point. Sometimes it's used the character does one thing at the beginning of the movie, it does a similar thing at the end, and you can see how they've changed. I think that I have to wrap it up.
This has been part two of Steve Hickner's presentation on story structure. Be sure and check out his next lecture, How Animation and Live Action Influence Each Other, in the next two episodes of the BYU Animation Podcast.